Good morning. Please be seated. And this is City of Seattle versus American Healthcare Services. I just remind council that in between you approaching the podium, the bailiff will sanitize it. So when the first council sits down, wait a moment for that to happen. All right.
Good morning and good afternoon. I'm Jean Cheadler Brown. I represent American Healthcare Services and Gideon Oyeleke and in this appeal. And there are three major issues, I think.
How much time do you want to reserve?
Oh, I'm sorry. 5 minutes, please. There are three major issues today that the court will need to look at, I think. One is whether or not to hear this appeal. The second one is whether or not the plaintiff failed to present a prima facie case specifically showing medical evidence that she could perform the essential duties of her job, and other required prima facie evidence for a discrimination case based on disability. And thirdly, whether or not there was any evidence of retaliation in the case after the claimant, after the employer came forward with a reasonable management decision when there was an intervening act of the employee, no calling and no showing, that was a terminable offense. So there was a reasonable management decision, and did the claimant come forward with any information about pretext? And the answer is no. The first issue, should this court consider this case? Well, yes, the court should. This is the same case that it would have been had RALJ never been adopted, because Rule 1.1C of RALJ says it in no way affects the appeal procedures under the statutory writs. The statutory writs do provide for appeal, and there's no contrary case law.
Within several days of your scheduled March argument, we conveyed a message to you alerting you that we'd expect you to address a particular statute. I think it's 4963.30. It doesn't sound like you're planning to do that, which tends to surprise me. So maybe you could do that now. You've had 4 months to contemplate the question. How does that statute apply to this case?
Well, Your Honor, I do apologize. I don't recall receiving that message. If I did receive it, I don't know that I received it, and I'm sorry. I have no other information on that.
You don't have an answer about the statute.
Pardon me?
You don't have an answer about the statute.
I don't have an answer of your question. 4960 is the state law against discrimination. I know that relates to all of the forms of discrimination that are civil rights in the state of Washington. And I did cite in my brief the elements of the WAC that...
Let me ask you a hypothetical question.
Okay,
hypothetically, if there was a statute that said that those cities of, I don't know if it's a first-class city or whatever it is, with more than 125,000 population, set up a procedure such as the procedure that Seattle set up here, and that those decisions were appealable as a matter of right, would that resolve the question of whether or not this case is appealable as a matter of right?
Well, as represented, I would have to say yes. Certainly, that statute would sound very
dispositive. It's a statute that appears to apply only to the city of Seattle.
Okay. So. Thank you for that. I would argue further on the discretionary review elements, but I think I'll go on to the merits of the matter very briefly. In this case, the Seattle Municipal Code was never mentioned by the Superior Court judge. That code codifies some of the most important prima facie elements of any discrimination case based on disability. Specifically, that creates a statutory or an ordinance burden to show the proper performance of the particular work involved. That is an affirmative requirement. Secondly, that it specifically refers to medical documentation in the criteria for the showing of discrimination on the basis of medical impairment in SMC 1404020. Now, that's really no different from the uncontested authorities that have been presented to this court by both parties, and the fact that many cases based upon the failure to meet this module of evidence have already been dismissed and have been approved on appeal for dismissal by both federal and state authorities. So the fact that the Superior Court never addressed these creates a situation where there is no direction to the hearing examiner if the case were reversed to go back to the hearing examiner. And furthermore, these cases make it clear that a failure to accommodate cannot exist until an accommodation has been requested. And I challenge the city in its opening statement what accommodation was requested.
Thank you.
And I reserve. Thank you.
Wait for the sanitation.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Cindy Williams for the City of Seattle, the Seattle Office for Civil Rights, and the Seattle Office of Labor Standards. First, I would reiterate what counsel said. The city did not receive the direction regarding 4963.
Okay. All I can assume is that because you requested out, that for some reason you didn't get it. I don't fully understand why not, and it's incredibly frustrating to be here 4 months later. So here's the situation.
Okay.
It's not a hypothetical. There is a statute that applies only to your client that says that you can set up this administrative process to vindicate claims pursuant to 4960. And if you do, it's subject to judicial review. Then there is a case, Cabalas, which we also tried to tip you off to, that says if it's done wrong, if somebody seeks a writ of review, it doesn't matter. The review takes place within the perimeters defined by the statute. So take me at my word that that's what the law provides. Is there any remaining thing that you would like to tell us about whether this case is properly here and we should be considering it on the merits?
Again, similar to counsel, I'm not prepared to answer it, not, having reviewed that. But
if I'm lying to you?
I know I'm not saying that, Your Honor. But I will respect the court's reading of that statute.
I mean, we did our best to tip you off and to let you know when you were coming in. I assume because you... somebody got working on canceling your appearance and probably put it away to be done another time. Then you were on another calendar and didn't want to be on that calendar. And then you're on this calendar. So somewhere in the course of things, apparently, you didn't get tipped off, which still doesn't explain to me why when there is a statute that applies only to your client and resolves a question at issue and a case that applies it, a published case that applies it, why it's incumbent on the court to tip people off in the first place.
Well, again, I apologize that it appears that counsel and I didn't receive that message and we weren't as prepared.
Well, more
as
to the point,
more
to the point, you didn't know the law that applies to your client. You only have one client and this law only applies to your client. I mean, I don't know what else to say. It's so frustrating to be here at this point after all of this time having gone to waste.
I understand. What I would like to address first is the city's main concern with this appeal is the potential for a very bad precedent for workers if this court is to find that under these facts that the employer does not bear any responsibility for establishing an employee's fitness for duty in a case like this, where somebody says, your disability makes you unable to work, we think that, we're going to suspend you or terminate you, and we're going to do the things that the respondent did in this case, which was kind of badger her doctors. I don't want to characterize it incorrectly, but communicate with her doctors, both with the timing and the content, that was very strong evidence of retaliation. The initial contact that they made with her doctors, that AHS made with the ARNP treating Ms. Pope, was it happened 2 days after they found out about the investigation. It didn't happen at the time she asked for a reasonable accommodation. And I'll address what I think counsel may address about her reasonable accommodation in a moment, but it did not. It didn't happen then. It didn't happen when she got some sort of complaint about how she was caring for Mr. Jackson. It happened right after they found out about the investigation. Their later attempts to get information from the doctors was similar to the first. They asked them, "Can you give us an opinion as to her fitness for duty?" And when they heard the provider responded, "We don't do that. That's not what we do. We don't do an occupational medicine evaluation. We don't do fitness for duty." They simply did nothing. And there's not authority that an employer has to do a fitness for duty evaluation, but gosh, if they don't do it, they do that at their peril, because they're then in court with facts like these, and they haven't done their due diligence to make their own case that they're doing anything other than retaliating against somebody or discriminating against them.
The Superior Court's ruling was an appellate ruling that there were, at a minimum, material facts at issue.
Correct.
Right? So you don't have to carry the day that the facts are established. You have to carry that the Superior Court was correct, that there were facts in
dispute.
That's correct.
That's correct. And we did show that, because there were one of the issues that raises a legitimate issue of material fact is the absence of that fitness for duty evaluation. So that's the role that plays. The other thing that the city is concerned about as far as a precedent or as far as a broader application of these facts is the fact that American Healthcare confused fitness for duty in general, just the general question of can you do your job, and issues of safety and danger. And the case law is clear. If you raise an issue of danger, if you raise an issue saying that this person's disability makes them unsafe to be an employee, the employer clearly has the burden of proof there. And AHS did nothing to rise to the level of that burden of proof.
Do you want to address whether there's an issue of fact about whether your client requested an accommodation? That was something opposing counsel challenged you to do when she was making her presentation.
Yes. She did not request a specific reasonable accommodation, but the application of that in this context is that when the case law says a plaintiff has the burden to show that a reasonable accommodation is available, that's a litigation burden. The thing that is triggered by the employee saying, hey, I'm having a problem doing a part of my job because of a medical condition, what's triggered then is a good faith exchange of information. The obligation that they just work together to find a solution. So there isn't a specific obligation in what I would call real life, on the ground, in the job, for the employee to come forward and say, I need this one thing. The thing that's triggered is that they start the interactive process.
What is the minimum level of information the employee needs to bring forward to trigger this interactive process?
It's not much at first, because the employer can ask for more. The employer can ask for additional medical information upon being notified that there is a medical issue. If the employer says, I believe you, I've seen you at work, I don't need to hear from your doctor, I don't need any additional information, then, they can go forward from there. There's no requirement that an employer get more information.
Is it enough for an employee to say, I can't do this, identify some task because associated with a medical condition, and just communicate that information and no more if the employer, is that enough?
It is to start the process, and it's because what's...
So what's the employer obliged to do once it hears that?
Let the employee know if they need more information from either the doctor or the employee about what would be helpful, what is the basis. The employer is entitled to know why. The employer is entitled to know, you know, that there is a real thing going on, that there's a real relationship between the medical condition and the inability to do some task at work. So they can get information, they can get additional information from the doctor, but they don't have to. And that's all part of the working together, that's what's triggered is, hey, you have to start working together to find a solution. There isn't... I want to address the SMC 1404-050D. AHS did brief that. That is the subsection in the SMC that simply says it reiterates the qualified to work standard. It doesn't add anything. It doesn't subtract anything. I would also like to address the council's criticism of the Superior Court order. That's immaterial for this court's review because this is an administrative decision and you go directly to the administrative record and review it by the standard of review.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the city's first point was that there's retaliation here because even though Ms. Pope had a no-call, no-show and she deserved to be terminated, the way in which the city asked the doctor for information was obviously retaliatory.
Don't you think it's more related to the timing of the request rather than the manner of the request?
Well, the request was actually made 16 days before she no-called, no-showed. And the request was...
Well, what counsel is telling us is that there was some action taken that notified your client that the city was getting involved, and that 2 days later the request was made to the doctor. Does that raise a reasonable inference of what was motivating the employer's request?
It raises the inference that the employer took the complaint seriously and wanted to find out medical information, which is the other part of...
Is that the only inference one could reasonably draw?
I think so. The city is saying that the employer has all of these burdens, investigate medically, and yet the case law says the employer does not. This employer was going beyond what it needed to do. It was
This is a summary judgment. Posture for this case. Could one reasonably infer that as soon as somebody found out there had been a complaint, they started gathering information that they had an impure motive?
I don't think you can assume that when a person knows that an individual has a discrimination case based upon an impairment, that the person then inquires about the impairment to obtain information and attaches a job description and says, can this person perform?
Well, was this the first time the employer in this case knew about an impairment possessed by the employee?
No. About a month and a half earlier, the employer was about to discipline the employee when it first learned that she has memory loss.
Any inquiry at that point to the physician or healthcare provider for the kind of information that was requested later once the complaint was made known to the employer?
Well, there was not, and there were no further complaints. There was an attempt by the employer to settle out when the employee had or had not called in. So the point here for retaliation, though, let's say it was retaliatory. Let's say someone says, well, I could draw an inference that this letter was retaliatory. Ms. Pope no-called, no-showed and created a public safety problem for the clients of this employer. That was a subsequent act, and the employer responded in a reasonable way. The employer said, you know, I cannot keep you on staff, but I still would like to hear from your medical provider how you can be safe around my clients.
And you tell us that's the only reasonable inference that can be drawn from the timing of the sequence of events you've described?
It is the only reasonable inference because that is the order of proof in a retaliation claim.
I understand the order of proof and the burden shifting, but you're telling us that if we look at this fact at this point in time, this fact at this point in time, and this fact at this point in time, this is the only reasonable inference that can be drawn, and I'm questioning that assertion.
And I guess what I'm saying is, yes, that's true. When an employee takes an act that could result in termination
at-will employment. But wasn't that disputed? Didn't she say that there had been alternative arrangements made for that no-show, no-call day?
She said she and her client agreed, but the client called and complained that her caregiver did not show up. She then refused to meet with her employer on Friday, instead choosing to meet Monday, and the employer actually had to cover, and then she did not want to go back to service that client. So she was put on medical leave. So the employer made a reasonable management decision, and that decision cannot be found to be retaliatory when she was really subject to termination and she was not terminated. And the employer can't be found to be retaliating because they are investigating from their perspective the only way they can about a complaint that's been made against them and trying to find out, what can I do to keep this person on staff? I'll ask her doctors. Now, the city says the employer should have done more than ask the doctors, had actually gotten their own doctor and had her evaluated. That is absolutely not required in the case law. What is required, if you want to say that the interactive process was reached, is for Ms. Pope to cooperate and for her doctors to answer. But her first doctor said, I'm not qualified to answer. Her first doctor, 3 weeks later, said, you know what? Can't do it. I'm just a nurse. The second person never identified themselves or showed any qualifications. And that's the failure of a prima facie case. There just isn't any data here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that concludes our calendar for today. We're adjourned.